Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is This Week in Radio Tech, episode 105, recorded November 2nd, 2011. Multi-label packet switching. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Omnia Audio and the new Omnia 11. Check out the countdown clock, to the end of a big sale going on at omniaaudio.com. It's time for This Week in Radio Tech. Hi there, I'm Kirk Hardegg. I'm so glad you've joined us. We got a cast of some great engineers with us, and the chat room is with us, and you're with us too. So, hey, we're ready to do the show. We've got a terrific episode with us. I'm so proud to have with us Bob Holowenko. We'll go to Bob in just a second, but first, let me introduce our other co-host. We have from Mukwonago, Wisconsin, Mr. Chris Tarr, the Ninjineer. Hello, Chris.
Hello there, Kirk. How are you?
Man, I'm great. How are you? That's the question up there in the north. You got any cold weather yet?
No, actually, it's been really, really nice. Yesterday was almost into the 60s, so we're doing all right. A little busy. We're starting to build out a 5,000 square foot addition to our facility. So I've been working a lot with architects and designers lately. So it's been keeping me busy.
I should ask you this question off the air, but you know, have you thought about your console choices?
Yeah, we're going to get the old Gates Yard consoles, and that's what we're going to put in the studios.
We've got a LiveWire SIM module for those consoles, so you can still plug them right into LiveWire, no problem. Good to see you, man. And you'll be joining us on the show. You're on the show, also on the show from the Hudson Valley of New York. It's Tom Ray, who has just returned from a hell of a trip to Hartford.
Yeah,
hi, Tom.
I was up over in at our stations in Connecticut today. It's like a war zone over there after the snow over the weekend.
Well, tell you what, as soon as we introduce our guest, let's hear your stories from the last few days and all the snow and stuff. Are you ready to tell those stories?
Yeah, I'm sure you'll find it interesting, especially I've got a realization here to give everyone, and I'm sure you'll find it flabbergasting.
Well, that's one thing we have not enough of on the show, and that's realizations. So we'll get to that in just a minute. Our guest on the show, I'm really glad to have this guy on. We've been talking for, geez, almost a year. It's Bob Holowenko, who is, well, Bob, you're a network guru from Vancouver, British Columbia. Hey, Bob, how are you?
Doing well. Thanks, Kirk.
Glad you're here. You're going to be educating us on some key network issues that folks come across when they deal with telco, with phone companies and such. Is that right?
Yep. Trying to open people's eyes to what's out there.
So, Bob, you're a ham radio operator, and I was just on your blog website today. Well, tell me where was I? What was the URL for your website?
That would be ve7wnk.ca. It's basically a place where I throw together my ramblings on amateur radio. One of my big hobbies, one of the aspects of that side of radio that I like, is contesting. So I've got things on there about contesting. In fact, I've also got a recording of my QSO with Leo. It's the second item down. So
while everybody goes there, I didn't listen to it yet, but yeah, people should go there to ve7wnk.ca.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, check that out. Well, Bob, you're going to be the big feature in the second half of our show. But hey, please jump in and join us in our maniacal discussions here in the first half of the show. But you're going to be educating us on subjects such as ISDN and MPLS and IP audio and all this stuff, this networking that is beyond the horizon. It's beyond where we can do networking ourselves. We must depend on other parties like telcos to help us out. Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, good. All right. Let's bring it. Oh, our show is by the way, is brought to you by the folks at Omnia Audio. And there's a really interesting, very short lived promotion going on at Omnia Audio. If you just go to omniaaudio.com and see the countdown clock, you'll see the countdown to
the end of the promotion. Only 9 days and 3 hours and 44 minutes left as we're recording this show. Go to the website, omniaudio.com, and click on that, and you'll see what the promotion is all about. It's all about getting an Omnia 11 for a price that, I don't know, are we crazy? We're going to talk about that in just a little bit when we do the commercial. Right now, let's get back to the show. And, okay, Tom Ray, you were in Connecticut today, and I understand it was power lines down and trees down. Oh, tell me what you saw.
Trees down, telephone poles down, cables down all over the place. The primary reason I went in, our FM there, WDRC-FM, ended up off the air for a while. Part of the problem, we thought it was a generator problem. Turns out that the actual fuel tanks went dry. Once we got the generator started, we got back on the air. Everything was fine, and all of a sudden, we're off the air again because of the T1 quit that goes up to the site. It's for those who don't know, a T1's a data line, and we run all the audio and the HD information on it. So right now, it's, believe it or not, it's an FM that's on the air with the best we could do was a POTS codec. It's a Comrex hotline.
Yeah,
which actually is kind of cool because we play a kind of a late 60s, 70s, early 80s format. And quite frankly, the FM sounds like an AM station, and you probably heard most of those songs on AM radio. So,
how great. That's awesome. That is awesome. Yeah, I know several people have used Comrex hotlines, you know, for STLs in an emergency. Sure. Yeah, that's a great idea.
But here's the kicker. So you may be wondering why the T1 quit. Go ahead, Kirk. Okay. Ask me why the T1 quit.
You know, Tom, I've been wondering ever since you came back from this trip exactly why the T1 quit. Why did the T1 quit, Tom?
Well, you see, the phone company, who I'm not going to mention, but I'll tell you it's not Verizon, which has a central office on top of the mountain. It used to be a microwave site. It's now a central office. Their generator ran dry. And why did their generator run dry? Because they forgot to refill it after Hurricane Irene. And that is exactly what the tech told me.
Oh, wow.
This is the phone company. It's not a small phone company. It's like, oh, my God.
Well, you know, that does sound like the kind of mistake I would make, actually, is, you know, well, we went through this big disaster. Okay, well, when we get around to it, we're going to order some more fuel for the, write that down, next month, order fuel for the generator.
Yeah,
guess it's good to keep it topped up, isn't it?
Yeah, so, you know, we lost our T1, we lost our ISDN because those two circuits go through the central office up there. And here we are.
that reminds me of this, I'm a pilot, right? So, you know, there's usually two things useless to a pilot, and those two things are runway behind you, sky above you, and I'll add the third thing, fuel on the ground.
Those are
pretty useless things. So fuel at the fuel depot, the fuel company, the fuel distributor, that's pretty useless. It needs to be up on the mountain with the generator. So, okay, so the T1 line went down because the central office had no power. I guess their batteries were long gone. Yeah.
Yeah. By this, you know, the generator died. The batteries have about 4 hours capacity, and those died, and the slick went down, and oh, well.
Wow. Okay.
They ain't no well, mo, but the, re- and, well, and the reason the generator ran dry was you know, we've got about 2.5 days of fuel up there. And the problem was, this was very wet, heavy snow. And the leaves are still on the trees here. So you combine those two together. I mean, we're talking entire trees, oak trees, just 100-foot oak trees, just boom, split in half, toppled over. We couldn't get up the mountain. Nobody could get up the mountain. It took 2 days to clear it.
Gee, my name.
So this isn't a mountain that's in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's a state park. You could not get into it. But the snow in Connecticut, they had about, in this area, I'm going to say they had about a foot.
Okay. But so, it occurred when the leaves were still on the trees.
That's correct. And it was also at a time when the atmosphere was warm and then came down to, you know, being cold. So it was a wet, really wet, heavy snow. And normally that's kind of an issue for the trees, but not really. But now that you have all these leaves on it, well, you've got all this more space to grab the snow on the tree, and it snapped trees right and left. It's absolutely unbelievable what I saw today.
What about towers? Were any towers felled or affected by the snowfall? They're usually affected by ice.
They're usually affected by ice, and I don't. I haven't heard of any in this time around. I know there are a couple. Matter of fact, I stopped to talk to our tower contractor today about another project, and he was saying he was going out to, of all places, a cell site with a tower that was in trouble. It hadn't come down, but it was in trouble, so they were going out to do whatever they had to do to it. But I didn't hear of any towers, at least in Connecticut, coming down, and nothing that I know of here in New York, because we got the wet, heavy snow, too. And luckily, I'm able to be on tonight because we didn't get power back until almost Tuesday morning. So,
all right. So how many – did you have a case of a lot of radio stations being off the air in that part of the world, up in the Northeast, or were many of them, you know, well enough equipped to stay on the air?
I believe quite a few were well equipped in Connecticut, though, because of the multiple power failures and multiple things like T1s going down that nobody really expects to happen, because you're dealing with the phone company, and they're supposed to prevent against this stuff like this unless the wires come down. At some point, I'm going to say there were probably 10 stations in Connecticut that were down, but they're all back up for the most part. So,
hey, don't let this be a conversation just me and Tom. Chris Tarr, you live in a part of the world where there's a lot of snow and occasionally ice. And hey, Bob Holowenko, you work with a telco, and I'm sure they're in Vancouver. Do you have much snow there and ice in Vancouver, or is it mostly a rainy environment since you're so close to a marine environment?
You're exactly right. The moderating effect of the Pacific Ocean. Well, Mr. Weatherman, it helps get rid of a lot of the snow. We do get it. Not too big of a deal. I've never heard of a situation where snow took down more than a few branches.
Chris, how about you?
We get it all the time. In fact, we were just discussing this year was probably, in recent memory, we've had the most ice in the spring, ice buildup on towers and lines and stuff. And, we have kind of the same situation. We have a transmitter site in an area called the Baraboo Bluffs, which is kind of southwest Wisconsin. And it's fairly remote, fairly high up, and it's around a state park. And we have those issues where power can get unreliable. Now, fortunately, all of my sites, we either use RF for our studio transmitter links, or we use a T1 with an RF backup. So we don't really depend on telcos for much of anything. But the Fairchild Tower, the 2,000 foot tower in Fairchild, fell this spring with the ice storms. So we do get quite a bit of that. Usually, though, it's fall and spring when you get more ice than snow.
Yeah. Wow. So Tom, how long, there's still people without power in the Northeast. I mean, it's still a million people. What are they reporting tonight?
Well, in Connecticut, where I was, they were reporting about 629,000 people just in that state. They were expecting to have no, I take that back. It was 550,000, 629 this morning. And they're now saying that they expect to have just about everybody back by Sunday night, Monday morning, right around midnight. So that should be good. But boy, from what I saw today, they got a heck of a job ahead of them. Here in New York, up in my area, just about everything's restored, so that's not a problem. Wasn't too bad. I was down at the WR transmitter in Jersey on Saturday for a while during the storm. And we didn't lose power. We did lose a phase a couple of times, which was interesting. Lights stayed on. Transmitter dropped off. Transmitter hummed. Transmitter came back up. Life was good. So it depends on where you are and depends on how many trees you had around you. That was the luck of the draw. What do you have for trees? And do you have a chainsaw?
You know what I found in a lot of times in these events with snow, and we've had some flooding too, is you'd be surprised what some beer and a pizza will get you in terms of help with things like getting a propane tank filled, getting trees cleared from our driveway. We had a the driveway leading up to our transmitter site goes up a hill, and we needed to get the fuel truck up there. Excuse me. So problem was the road was washed off. Well, right next to us, the business next to ours down the road is a quarry. We went down there, and one of the guys at the quarry brought up a whole truckload of pea gravel to fill in our driveway for the low, low price of a six-pack. So, you know, you'd be surprised what you could buy for that.
I've always heard that, yeah, a pizza or a station T-shirt. You'll go raid the prize closet, give the phone guy or the power line guys some T-shirts. Or not so much now, but certainly a few years ago, a pack of cigarettes would get you a long way to get your phone problems fixed. So, I had a question on the tip of my tongue, and of course now the chat room's been talking quite a bit about burying power lines and phone lines. I've heard of certain power companies that says, hey, if any given stretch of line we have to go replace or put back up, twice in a certain number of years, we will go back in and bury those lines. That's got to be really expensive, though. The cheapest lines in the world are those that are, overhead on power poles. Tom, Chris, Bob, what do you think about this, about burying power lines, cost versus, I mean, obviously we're the consumers of power, so hey, it's great for us if lines are buried to our transmitter sites and they're not susceptible to weather. They're certainly susceptible to backhoe fade. Tom, Chris, Bob, what's been your experience here? I'll go to Tom first. Tom, you got experience with the possibility of burying power lines?
Not really the possibility. I've heard it talked about. I obviously, you're right. For us, it's a good idea. But I guess what it'll boil down to on the utility company's side is cost to benefit ratio. I mean, they'll have to take a time period. 10 years, I don't know, and take a look at what it costs them to restore power in a certain area and what it's going to cost to actually trench and bury these things and replace all the wiring, of course, in that area, and see if they're going to eventually make money on it at some reasonable time period. And that's literally what it's going to come down to.
You know, in the chat room, folks are saying, hey, in Australia, power lines are mostly underground, and the same thing in the U.K., power lines are, at least in their areas where the chat room members are, mostly underground. Of course, a lot of new subdivisions now in a residential area here in Nashville, it's you can always tell the high end subdivisions have their power lines underground, and the working man subdivisions don't. In fact, they have even uglier power lines. Seem to go right over the middle of the street with lots of lines, just overhead mess. Chris Tarr, you got buried power lines in your part of the world?
Yeah, in my neighborhood, power lines are buried. Now, out of my transmitter sites, most of them have above-ground power lines. And I'll tell you, I mean, living in probably one of the more difficult areas when it comes to running power lines, I don't really see a lot of difference in reliability between the buried and the unburied. So, I'm kind of on the fence on it. I have one of my sites is buried, the other one isn't. And I'll tell you, they have about the same rate of failure in terms of power issues. Because really, in order for it to be really effective, it needs to be buried from the time it leaves the substation until the time it gets to your facility. And chances are, no matter where you are, the entire infrastructure is not buried. There are parts where it starts above ground and then goes down. And a lot of the time, that's where the problems are. It's not necessarily in the neighborhood. And then there's the other benefit too. When there is actually a problem, it's a whole lot easier to find when you can see it. That doesn't happen often, but you hear stories of things getting in there and cutting the power lines and things like that. Well, then you've got to try to go find out where it's broken. And if you can't visually see it, it makes it a lot more difficult. So, in my mind, most of my sites, all my sites have generators and things like that. I don't know that I'd want the utility company spending all that money to bury them.
Yeah, and then the high voltage, the cross country transmission lines. You really can't bury those, can you? I don't think so. And back in 1990, was it 93 or 94? Big ice storm came through Mississippi. I was part owner of a radio station there at the time. I guess I still am. And it brought down the high voltage transmission lines for tens, probably 100 miles. In fact, there was all these transmission lines were down in such a large area that our local power plant couldn't fire back up because they had no power. And they had no way to, they had to bring power in, get that fixed before the local generating plant could power up. Bob, what about your area? You guys have in Vancouver, they bury power lines there?
Power lines, telco lines, a lot of the different things. Pretty much when it comes to aerial versus buried lines, it's always call before you dig, the rule of thumb, because you never know really where they are. In a lot of the subdivisions, the telco lines, the cable TV lines, the power will run through the back alley on aerial. In a lot of the newer subdivisions where they're trying to, you know, get as much room as they can, they don't build the back alley type design. So you end up with a lot of underground cable, which is nice. It's prettier until something goes wrong. You get something that goes and chews it up. Now, I will tell you that buried cable is not as susceptible to copper theft, which has become a bit of an issue with the price of copper going up. It's a little more effort. But, you know, if you're a cable tech and you are trying to find out why you've got an open on a pair, you throw your TDR on there, time domain reflectometer, and you want to find out where the issue is. And if it says it's 10 feet away and 10 feet in front of you is a bunch of dirt, you're not always that happy. Because now you have to get the backhoe out. Your service is down for rack it up. You get areas where a cable is going under a chunk of highway. Well, you get somebody in installing new poles, installing a new intersection, installing anything. Somebody cuts through that. Well, it's a call to the city to get big intersections blocked off. The backhoes come out. It's a big ordeal. So as far as the larger transport stuff, sure, bury it. The stuff to the home, it's all cosmetic.
It is interesting the difference between burying different utility services. That's not what the show is supposed to be about, but you know the weather does kind of bring up this subject. I for one am very glad that in most cities we bury sewer lines. I think that's a darn good idea. Water lines too, probably a good idea to bury those. But the power lines. Somebody in the chat room just said, "Hey, I used to fix transmission lines. I'd rather climb 10 poles." Than to have to get the backhoe out and find a problem that way. Sure would. Wow. Okay, well, let's move on because we're going to get to the commercial break shortly and then get on to what Bob Holowenko is going to educate us about, and that is how to get good quality service and how to order the right things from your telco and what options may be available for you for getting signals from here to there. And really, we're talking about the new world of that, and that is an IP, and that's what Bob's an expert in. The other thing I want to touch on, though, is this national EAS test. Yes, we've talked about this a few times, and in a previous show, we let you know about a video that's available on YouTube to show you how the test should go. There was an email just today from the Society of Broadcast Engineers reminding us about final preparations for the national EAS test. It happens a week.
Did you scroll down to that email, by the way? Because there was something else mentioned in there as well.
Oh, look at no, I didn't until you just said. Look at that. There is there's the rugged face of Chris Tarr, the engineer. Talking about a streaming radio webinar on December 6th. That's pretty cool. Well, let's make sure we mention that in future shows. That's cool. Does it cost money?
That's like
to attend.
Yeah, it's $30, I think.
Okay, all right. I think it's $39. All right. Well, we'll promote that on after we get past this EAS test. We'll promote that coming up December 6th, St. Nicholas Day. Mark your calendars. A streaming radio webinar with Chris Tarr, who personally benefits from all the paid attendees.
I do not. But anyway, continue. Well,
you don't.
Okay. No, I don't get paid.
All right. Well, this EAS test is coming up a week from the day that we're recording this. In fact, by the time we do the next episode of This Week in Radio Tech, we should have already been past it. Now, there's been concern made to me and others about the fact that, hey, some of the bigger broadcasters, Clear Channel, Cumulus, and Citadel, which is now Cumulus, they have been laying off a number of people here in the U.S. In the last few days. And perhaps there's going to be even more voice tracking and more unattended operations at radio stations when this EAS test occurs on November the 9th. Well, concerns been raised. Gee, this is a bad time to let people go when we're going to do this test. And I can understand that complaint. But I'd also like to point out that, well, these tests are supposed to happen unattended. And that is kind of the purpose of the test, is to make sure that this information gets disseminated from the White House through every participating radio station, which should basically be all of them, to get the president's message, should that be the case, out to the listening public. Tom, you got a notion about this? Should this happen unattended, or is this going to require people at your station to push buttons and turn dials?
It's supposed to happen unattended, and if your EAS box is installed properly, that's exactly what's supposed to occur. And actually, as you said, just about all stations should be participating. There's a great incentive for them to do it, because with the EAS test handbook that was downloaded, it states very, very plainly in there, if you decide to be a non-participating station, you will sign off during the time that the test is occurring.
Let me add something to that, though. You're right that it should be unattended. However, because we've never done this before, there are some caveats to that. They are saying there's a possibility your box won't release the programming. There's a release the alert and go back to programming. It may require a restart. It may require an abort. Some are saying under certain circumstances you need to send a weekly test. So they're supposed to run unattended, but we've never done it before, so we don't know what's going to happen. Now, as for like the Clear Channels of the world, if I'm not mistaken, they actually have a centralized location where they can monitor the EAS of all of their stations and see what's going on. So I'm not as concerned about that. But you're right that it should run unattended. The problem is we don't know what's going to happen. So there's a possibility that there may need to be some human interaction there.
But I'll counter that by saying that we do tests every week, and things release and things happen. So what's really the difference? Except the code that's coming in is EAN.
Well, the difference is going to be we don't know, because it's got to go through so many hops, if the end of message is going to get relayed properly and that sort of thing. I mean, that's what's been come up in the discussions about it, is there's possibility that, several steps back, that the end of message isn't going to get relayed and these things are just going to hang open. And they just don't know. So on a weekly test, we know it runs. We've done it a million times, so we know that's going to be fine. We've never done a test of this magnitude, so we assume everything's going to be fine, but we just don't really know until we run the test.
No, that's true. Mm-hmm. But on most of these, at most of these stations anyway, I mean, it's not like there's nobody sitting there. Somebody's in, and actually they've asked that that somebody be watching to see what goes on, because the FCC does have a reporting feature, and they want to know what happened to your station. They want to know why it happened. They want to know, basically what they're asking is, how do we fix it if it didn't work? So there really needs to be somebody there. But if you've got six stations in the cluster, the nicest thing is that each station has one person watching each station. But the reality is that's probably not going to happen. So if you have one person watching it, hey, that's right. You'll be able to report.
I think that was the concern of some of the emails going around today is, what if there isn't anybody? And I think that's probably unlikely. But, it's an interesting thought. How are you making plans for that? And what happens if it's a, in fact, I have a client station who they have two stations and one guy to go between the two stations. Which one is he going to be at when it happens? So, there are some, I don't think it's pretty widespread, but I think there are some things, and some people are a little bit on high alert about that. I agree with you, Tom. However, I think it's going to be all ado about nothing. I think it's going to be just fine. But I think there are some people who are concerned just because of the unknown.
We shall see.
I just want to know when I get to place my head between my legs and kiss my butt goodbye. That's
right. Well. We'll see. I think we've shown it a couple times on the website. Go back and review previous casts. If you want to Google FCC Emergency Alert System or EAS Nationwide Test, you'll find out information about that. And you can, in fact, you're required to have this handbook at your station, apparently. So download it, it's PDF, print it out, stick it at the point of EAS control, and make sure you understand what it says. Should be good. All right. Hope it works out well. If it doesn't, I'm not going to worry about our national security. But yeah, it'd be good if it worked out well. All right, we're going to take a quick break here and hear from our sponsor. And at the conclusion of that message, we're going to bring Bob Holowenko in here. Bob, you're going to be the star, so you stand by, put your makeup on, get your hair going, and we'll talk to Bob about educating us about various services from the phone companies that you may not know about, and you may want to now in this new era of lots of IP connectivity. Hey, let's turn our attention to the sponsor of the show, and that is actually my employer, one of my employers, and that is Omnia Audio. The website, omniaaudio.com. If you take yourself to that website, just type in your browser, Omnia, O-M-N-I-A, omniaaudio.com, you'll see a countdown clock right on the website. What is it counting down to? Well, I don't know. Sometimes numbers kind of work out, you know. I think Louis Farrakhan was into the number 19. Well, Omnia is into the number 11. We have the top of the line processor from Omnia is the Omnia 11. If you haven't ever watched Spinal Tap and seen Nigel Tufnell talk about it goes to 11. You ought to get yourself that movie, or you can just If you go to YouTube, you'll find several clips of Spinal Tap with Nigel Tufnell saying it goes to 11. Well, that's the idea behind the Omnia 11. It does go to 11, and that doesn't mean it gets more distorted. That means it gets really incredibly loud and clean. Well, here's the deal: in honor of the number 11 and the Omnia 11, we know we're coming up on the date 11, 11, 11. And by the way, that works whether you live in a country that puts the month before the day or the day before the month. It's the same thing. It's 11, 11, 11. And so we're having 11 days countdown where the Omnia 11 is available at a reduced list price of $11,111.11. Yeah, and you have 11 days to take advantage of that. Now, you don't contact Omnia directly. We won't sell it to end users directly. This discount is available through your dealer. And there's a whole list of Omnia dealers. It's right there on the website. Check that out. In fact, if you just go to the website, click on the countdown clock, the next link will take you to a list of all our dealers. And there's another link for the brochure. The Omnia 11, here's what people have been saying about it. And, hey, 3 years ago when we put the first beta unit on the air in Philadelphia, the engineer there said, wow, it sounds effortlessly loud. You know, up to the point of the Omnia 11, for audio processors to sound loud, they had to sound like they were trying to sound loud. You get my point? You know, the more you cranked up a processor, the more it sounded like it was really trying to be loud. Well, Frank Foti, Corny Gould, Rob Dye, the rest of Team Omnia have found a way to sound loud and clear, and yet take a breath, be relaxed, and print on the dial just as loud as any other station, if not louder, but also do away with the intermodulation distortion. And, you know, that's the real culprit. That's the real bane of audio processing is intermod distortion. When you've got all these multiband compressors and limiters acting on the audio and kind of, in a way, vibrating, you know, getting the bass notes to end up modulating vocal passages. And then getting high energy, high frequency audio to end up kind of dulling everything down as the limiters and clippers work on those things. Well, the Omnia 11 is quite different. It's really, the controls are set up similar to what you're used to, but internally the processing architecture is quite different, and the intermodulation distortion is just totally moved out of the way into places you're not hearing it, or eliminated, or vastly reduced. The first time I heard an Omnia 11 on the air, I was driving a rental car into Cleveland, Ohio, going to the company. I was going in at midnight or so, going to go get my hotel room, and then the next morning going into Telos, my employer. And driving this rental car in, I tuned into a station, WNCX. It's a rock station. And I heard the end of the Little Steven show, and then came on a Fleetwood Mac song. I heard the Fleetwood Mac song, and I'm thinking, wow, is that a new mix of the Fleetwood Mac song? I cranked it up. I thought, wow, that sounds like I've never heard that before. That's just amazing. I could hear every instrument, and nothing was distorted. And yet, it was just as loud on the dial as anybody else. So, effortlessly loud, that's the benefit of the Omnia 11. go to the website and check it out. OmniaAudio.com. See the countdown clock. That's how many days, hours, minutes, and seconds that you have to place an order to get an Omnia 11 for $11,111.11. That price is good around the world. Check it out. Thanks a lot. Thanks to Omnia Audio for sponsoring the show. All right, Bob Holowenko, come on in here and educate us. I think you've got a little preamble here, and then we've got a few slides to show to help help us understand networking from the phone company when you have to use them. Take it away, Bob.
I guess it's a little bit hard to sell Zephyrs if you don't have somebody at the phone company.
That's right.
I keep up to date on a lot of the publications for broadcasters, and a couple of them happen to come into my inbox that show a lot of IP connectivity. Pretty much every diagram shows a good old-fashioned, it's kind of hard to say old-fashioned, Ethernet network. Pretty much everything from VoIP to AOIP, LiveWire, is running over Ethernet now. And having things within the LAN environment is great. You've got a low latency, completely autonomous system where you can control everything. Well, now that everything's going IP, a lot of things you're going to want to be able to reach them from other points around the area. I see a lot of things like IPSTLs. Chris, you were talking about one a couple weeks ago, or maybe a couple months ago by now. All kinds of different IP-based solutions, SIP solutions. There's all kinds of things that a broadcaster will have that's going to be IP-based. Well, I'm going to talk a bit about bringing that to the WAN, to the other sites. There's quite a few different technologies out there that somebody would have. You've got all kinds of different internet connections, be it through a DSL provider, cable provider, maybe a Fios or fiber-based service, even a wireless type system that goes over top of a cellular network. They're all options to bring data to a site or to have interconnectivity, but you might have a lot of different mission-critical things going on at a remote site or branch to branch between two locations. You might want to be able to share large audio files. Maybe you trigger a news event from one studio to multiple stations. And right now, a lot of broadcasters are using expensive satellite links, telco interties to do that sort of thing. Being able to do it over maybe an already existing IP network might be easier for them. And there's lots of solutions. I've got a particular customer who was doing basically IP everything. They had their backup STL was IP. All their level monitoring for their AM site was all over IP. Their silence monitor. They had a weather station, a tower camera, a couple of cameras so that they could see, oh yeah, Jim, the cameras are, the towers are still standing. They could also, they had a camera on top. All kinds of things that are very, very IP intensive, including some important things. For the FM that was at the same location, they actually had a trigger, an SNMP trigger for the NO2 pump, which is pretty important. HVAC systems, all kinds of different things. Looking for a technology that's going to handle the high bandwidth of something like a high quality VoIP, or in your case, the AOIP. Most people are probably going to look at something like a fiber-based solution. They're going to look at something like, the next slide's probably going to be a little more beneficial for this. They're going to look at something like a fiber solution, a bonded T1, a single T1, all kinds of things. But if you've got a bunch of locations, and I just threw this together quite quickly, where you're going to want to have connectivity between multiple branches. So using this design, say you've got a studio in Vancouver, Mukwonago, Los Angeles, Nashville, and Miami. I tried to spread all around the map. If I had a big file that I wanted to transfer from, say, stream or anything in a hub and spoke configuration on the way existing networks. Let me back up a bit. Current WAN technologies, a lot of them, well, not even current, a lot of technologies use a hub and spoke model. So you'll have a central head office. In this case, I've put New York as the head office. And you'll build a connection. Either you'll have it over the internet with a VPN concentrator, or you'll buy a solution from a from a telco where you might have a single PVC that goes from your branch office to your HQ. But you end up with problems where if you want to transfer something large, say in this case from Vancouver to LA, you have to bounce across the continent and back. So you have to send something from Vancouver to New York. It then has to be reflected with no benefit out on another interface or the same interface to, in this case, Los Angeles.
So yeah, this got kind of like doubling back your data. You know, instead of going from, so let's say, Vancouver to Nashville, it's Vancouver to New York to Nashville. And by the way, you mentioned PVC. Is that short for a private virtual connection?
It is, yeah. Private virtual connection, private virtual circuit.
All right.
So obviously the better model is, and in today's day and age where you've got sites that are going to be sending data site to site, would be, next slide, would be a more of a mesh model. But this full mesh kind of looks like a full mess where you've got a PVC or a private virtual connection going to every single site that you may need to talk to. Vancouver might have a lot of data that it needs to receive from some recording industry exec in Nashville and in Los Angeles, but maybe there's not a lot of traffic going out to Wisconsin. You might not have a PVC there. Well, then you end up in situations where the routing's all confusing. Just looking, if you for the listeners, if you basically picture a hub and spoke, you've got your HQ in the middle and all your other branches kind of around it. Well, now imagine having to have a piece of string going from each of these spokes to every single other spoke. And, you know, there's a mathematical formula. It's like, you know, N times N minus 1 squared over 2 or something. The chat room will correct me. When you've got a mesh, though, you kind of need to start planning things a little bit differently. Sure, it's nice to have that extra pipe, but, okay, you got to start thinking, all right, I need how much bandwidth usually to go to LA? Okay, well, I don't usually transfer stuff to Wisconsin, so I'm not going to put a pipe there. You've got all these different individual little pipes that you have to maintain. You have to buy them, and each PVC is going to be, depending on your carrier, they're going to pay charge you kind of by the mile kind of thing. Or by the volume of pipes. Usually they're not dynamic, so you're going to have to buy dedicated bandwidth for each PVC. That issue is one that as companies started to grow, it wasn't really flexible for them. So a group of very smart, much smarter than I, engineers came up with a kind of a shared mesh, where the meshing became the telco's problem. Colin, if you go to the next slide, for those who are watching, basically the way that the MPLS world, using that as the kind of model here, the way it works is you'd have a single connection back to a telco device, but then they would share all the interconnects. It'd be their responsibility. They make sure that you've got this virtual connection. Now, even though you're using shared infrastructure, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be sharing, for instance, another person's dedicated infrastructure. You're going to be using virtualized infrastructure. So when you talk about an MPLS connection, you're actually talking about a type of VPN. It's not the type of VPN that's encrypted and goes over the internet. It's something that is essentially a point-to-point connection. So you'd have each branch connected to a provider, and the provider would then do all the routing, and they would take the best path. If you think about our previous example, where you had somebody going from Vancouver to New York to LA or to Nashville, think of the latency that's involved in that. You've got, what is it, like at least 60 MS coast-to-coast here in Canada. So in the States, I'm sure it's not much different. So you'd end up with, close to 100 MS when you're trying to transfer something in TCP, which is relay based. You've got SINs and ACKs flowing back and forth. And if your pipe's not big, it's going to really be constricted because it's got to wait for the next message to say, yeah, okay, go ahead, send. So you end up with a much slower connection. So with something like MPLS, if you picture basically just a mesh with a bunch of things hanging off of the mesh, it's going to know how to find the best path. The carrier is responsible for finding you the best path. So something that might have been 100 milliseconds for a transfer round trip time, maybe is now down to, in this case, Vancouver to LA, you know, you're looking at 15 milliseconds.
Really?
So it's a much cleaner, much smoother design. Now you don't need to worry about how much bandwidth you're going to buy to each city or to each branch. You basically just say, how much is this branch going to need? You know, okay. How much? What's all my right. average transfer? And really, it ends up cheaper for a lot of companies. You're actually taking money back from the telcos because you don't need to pay them as much to explain or to have these dedicated circuits. So, you know, that's one of the things that I really like. A lot of people ask, well, why would I do something like an MPLS instead of going over the internet? Well, truth be told, the internet, you could create a normal VPN site to site to site to site, which is a lot of work. Yeah. Most people use a single VPN concentrator at a headquarters site that has lots of bandwidth and they connect. Well, you've got the same dilemma as the hub and spoke. You've got the single point of failure. You've got the large round trip time. Not everybody has their HQ in the middle of the continent to make things easier. And the big thing is that, you know, the internet routing table is pretty complete, but the internet doesn't know geography. You know, so it might not be taking the best path by what a road would take. It's going to go by what its best metrics are. So, for instance, if I wanted to go to Nashville, I might still have to be going through Vancouver, or sorry, through out east, through New York and around.
Yeah. When you Bob, I want you to pause here for a second and clear up a couple of misconceptions for me. Now, I'm a small-time broadcaster. I'm part owner of a couple stations in Mississippi, and actually we're expanding there now again, and also a couple in American Samoa. And we've never, and we have an office in Las Vegas where my business partner lives, and I'm here in Nashville. We've never found a need for us to have any kind of virtual private networking or private virtual circuits and nothing like that. We've just always used the public internet to transfer music and program logs and do remote control and transfer billing and information and reconciled traffic logs. We've used the public internet available in Samoa and here to do Vonage phone calls, for example, voice over IP phone calls. At what point does a business grow or do your needs grow to where using the public internet isn't good enough or isn't optimal enough? How would my little group of stations grow, or at what point does a business need to start looking at more private services like you're talking about here?
Well, it all depends on how you're doing it. If all your sites are within one small geographical area and you're on one carrier, you're probably doing all right. If you start having to leave carriers, if you've got, like, well, obviously you're not going to have the same carrier in Samoa that you would probably in your home station, or you know what I mean, your local station. And when you start going between two providers, you can't tell what's going to happen to that traffic. The provider links, the provider-to-provider connection, the NNI, is often quite slow because there's tons of traffic going through it. You know, when Jim Bob down the road is trying to get the latest copy of his favorite DVD from his best friends on the torrent sites, well, you end up with that pipe getting saturated. And there's a lot of peer-to-peer traffic out there that you're contending with. A lot of other traffic, like VPN traffic, will get precedence on some provider's network, but there's no guarantee. And that's the problem with the internet, is that there's no such idea of what's called a committed information rate, or a CIR, or SLA. You get absolutely nothing through, guaranteed. What I was saying before about sometimes VPN traffic will be preferred, well, that's a type of QoS. Really, there is no such thing as QoS on the internet. If you've got a bunch of sites that are in one geographical area, that are, say, all within one state, one county, one province, you might be able to use a different technology instead of MPLS, which is more of a wide area technology. You might want something more like a metro Ethernet, like a switched Ethernet, where all of your sites will share one common broadcast domain. You could picture every single one being on a switch instead of it being on a routed technology. There's technologies that would basically allow you to have everybody on a common subnet. Now, there are design concerns with stretching a network out like that, but that's another option. In fact, that is the technology that the company that I'm working for uses to bring MPLS customers on, is that we use this thing called the Metro Network, and then services connect to the end of the Metro Network. What a Metro Network is basically just, it's often in ring topology. It's basically a group of switched connections that really give you a low latency connection. There's no routing. It's all just switching as if it was inside the LAN environment, or as if you had a point-to-point fiber connection, private connection between your sites. One of the big benefits of something like a metropolitan network is you get the concept of QoS. So you could have any of the flavors of QoS. And if you check out slide one, you'll see kind of how a lot of the providers do it. There's class of service. There's differentiated service code point bits. There's IP precedence and 1,000 different ways to do it. Here's an example of how a lot of the MPLS carriers do their traffic. Everybody does it differently. But with the different levels, you could have the it broken into, let's say, in this example, there's 4 levels. So your traffic that's considered gold or platinum, depending on who you're with, would be your VoIP traffic, the actual RTP stream, the actual call. There's silver, bronze, default. The other ones are basically, you just break them down. So when you make a SIP call, you've got 2 different types of traffic. You've got your RTP, you've got your actual dialing. So when you dial and press on the keypad, it's different than the type of traffic your voice is going over as. So they're going to be marked differently and treated differently. While you wouldn't want somebody dialing to interrupt a call, if you're in the middle of a call and all of a sudden somebody fires up some other type of transfer, then right?
Yeah, sure.
Not exactly what you want. So using QoS, you can mark certain types of traffic as priority. Now, a lot of the VoIP providers out there, Cisco, Avaya, Nortel, those companies will actually now on the sets, on the actual phone set, do all the marking for you. But your network needs to be able to understand that. If you're making a call between 2 different branches over the internet, that marking that you're phone provider has been, or your VoIP provider has been so kind to provide, isn't going to come over. I almost think that what I should have done was give homework before coming here, some required reading. the article that Steve Church wrote in your thing there, Kirk, your guys' magazine.
Oh, in the Telos catalog. Okay.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Like, aside from it being pointed towards broadcasters, I'd love to send this to my enterprise customers because it basically breaks down what audio over IP is, what VoIP is, and how these different things work. The codecs, the network designs, all kinds of different things. It's pointless for me to show it on the camera, but I should assign that as reading. Make sure you get your reading done to the listeners. But that's just one of the applications, VoIP and audio over IP, which you'd want to mark as the highest quality traffic. Now, you would do that either in your own router or you would have a contract where your provider does that for you. It's simple enough for them to do. It's a lot of things come in. You just need a managed switch.
Bob, help me understand and get something clear in my mind. If I want to do some quality of service tagging and have that tagging carry through my provider to another location of my business or another radio station, what has to be in place? Now, you've mentioned MPLS, and I kind of get that. What are the minimum requirements for my tagging to be effective through my path to wherever I'm wanting to go?
Pre-planning and a subscription. So basically, you would talk to your provider and say, listen, I expect that I'm going to have, the average codec being, 64 kilobits, maybe 10 calls. So I'm going to need 640K of this special EF traffic sent or to flow between site to site. Well, let's ramp it up and say 1 meg. You've got, let's say, a 10 meg fiber circuit pulled into your site. You'd want Yeah, see, it all depends on what you want to purchase. But you could have that pipe going out to your provider with dedicated. 1 meg is for this type of traffic. Other traffic can use it when it's not there, when there's no other traffic filling that buffer space. But I want this traffic to go out straight directly to the provider. No interrupts, no dropping, no packet loss to my other site. And to basically answer your question, what you need in place is something like a metro connection, like I was mentioning before, like on a MAN, a metropolitan area network. Or if you're going a long distance, then yeah, you would need something like an MPLS or VPLS solution with a provider that honors DSCP or COS, which are different types of marking for QoS.
You've mentioned Metro Ethernet a couple of times, or a metro area network. Now, is Metro Ethernet, isn't that a branding name? Is that a name like Kleenex? We all know what it is, and everybody can call it that. Metro Ethernet.
It is. Yeah, well, it is and it isn't. It's another one of these names that means absolutely nothing.
Okay.
They throw the word Ethernet on there to make the people that are actually going to be implementing it feel more comfortable. Oh, Ethernet, I know what that is. That's this chunk of cable that's in my hand here, this 8-wire cable. And essentially, that's really all it is. It's Ethernet delivered typically over fiber or another medium.
So, for broadcasters, see, I'm thinking in terms of broadcasters here and what we as broadcasters typically need to do. And of course, I relate that to the different IP audio products that are on the market, whether they're from Telos or from Comrex or from AEQ or other companies. So I'm thinking this way. I know that, you know, the highest level of quality required is for an uncompressed, unbuffered Ethernet stream like you'd get with LiveWire or with Wheatstone's Wheatnet IP. This pretty much requires the equivalent of a piece of Cat 5 cable to carry, and you can't have a bunch of latency going on there. And there are, I can speak for LiveWire, there are customers in the world, there are people using LiveWire over Metro Ethernet, like in Hong Kong. Across Victoria Harbor, there are two locations of Metro Radio and Metro Television, and they are connecting studios across the harbor with commercially available Metro Ethernet, and they're running LiveWire, which is, to me, just amazing that they're running LiveWire across this service. So that's kind of like the high end of what's available, Metro Ethernet. You know, it's almost like a piece of Cat 5 cable. And then next in line, I guess, you've got MPLS tagged or capable services where you are using maybe IP codecs. In the Telos line, we have the iPort, but there are others, other brands as well. You've got codecs that are, I would say, not smart codecs. You know, they produce a stream, and at the other end, they receive a stream with some buffering. But there's no smartness about the data rate or about the amount of buffering. It's fixed. And if you use an MPLS service there, then you can get a pretty reliable connection on that. And then finally, there's products that are designed to be used on the public internet. Like in the Telos line, we've got the Zip One. I think Comrex has the Access, for example, and it's designed to work over public internet, where there's some smarts in the codec to adjust the bit rate or the buffer size at the receive end to deal with all the vagaries that you have in the public internet. So have I kind of divided those three things into ways that kind of fit the public, you know, the what's available from phone companies or IP providers?
Yeah, that's exactly it. One of the things about Metro Ethernet or that kind of connectivity, it doesn't always have to actually be over an Ethernet, like a Ethernet over fiber type solution like you'd be used to in a WAN. We've got situations where we've got people using bonded T1s, bonded DSL, single DSL, single T1, frame relay circuits. It all depends on what a person's need is. But you touched on the main point there with the internet. It's often good enough for a lot of things. But when you need to be able to prioritize your traffic, you need something that's going to honor your QoS. You need something that's going to be low latency. That one thing that's a big point for a lot of people is the idea of an SLA, a service level agreement, or a CIR, committed information rate. Things you're not going to get with internet. Getting big internet bandwidth is cheap. So it's a lot of people are allured by that. The problem is that when you buy that big bandwidth, you might be buying, I don't know, a 30 meg connection. You might be buying or megabit per second connection, 100 megabit per second connection. But that's just an access technology. They're not going to guarantee that when you try to go to a specific website, that you're going to be able to pull down full line rate from that. Well, sometimes site to site, kind of what you need. So with a committed information rate and a service level agreement on a number of different things, be it packet loss, transfer speed, anything, that's something you'd deal with your provider, then you can end up getting a dedicated amount of traffic through without having to worry about, okay, well, if I do it during this time of day, the internet's really busy. Of course, there's still things like statistical multiplexing that go on. You're not guaranteed coast to coast that that is going to be your pipe. But if it's not delivered the way you expect it to, you can get SLA payback, where the telephone company, everyone's favorite part, pays you back if it's not how it's promised.
Right. And, here's another thing that should be clear too, is, you know, some these technologies are appropriate in what I like to call mission critical types of situations. We use MPLS at Intercom, but it's for our internal WAN for things like, our email systems. That's for our internal servers, that sort of thing. But when I stream our audio for our syndicated shows, we do have an SLA with the access point with bonded T1s, but it does go over the public internet. Again, generally 99.9% of the time, our end and their end, our send end and the receive end are, multiple T1 points with SLAs there, and the rest of it goes to the public internet, where, a little bit of delay, some buffering is probably not a big deal. You can probably get away with that most of the time. But when you're talking about, a corporation's email server or a corporation's phone system where you're using voice over IP, which we do, then you have to have that, it's not the size of the pipe that matters as much as the quality of service and the latency. So, that's where some of these technologies come in. So if you're a small radio station, you're probably not at that level where that's going to be a major deal. There's probably nothing that you're doing that's going to require that level of service. However, if your business depends on your phones working all the time and, your business depends on being able to get your audio there in the, with the packets in the right order with very little delay, then these are the types of technologies you're going to want to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that a lot of companies are starting to do is they're starting to look at if they've got a, this could be broadcast as well, but in the enterprise world, they're starting to look at how their money is being spent on data, technology. And so, they're thinking, why would I buy this really expensive link if I don't necessarily know that it's going to be completely useful for me? Mm. A lot of the sales type people out there, which I'm not, will kind of point out another couple of things that these companies are starting to learn. Well, if you're paying per site, maybe you've got into each site, you've got 12 phone lines, or into each site, you've got a smaller branch, maybe has two phone lines. We'll start counting up how much that costs and now compare that to what you would be able to save. And this is a kind of a plug for VoIP by maybe aggregating all of your connections, your voice connections into one location. So if you've got a head office, you pull a PRI into there. You can start doing it that way where you have all your dial tone provided out of an HQ site, and then you can terminate or disconnect all the other terminations that you've got. So you could end up saving money there. One of my customers who is a broadcaster is using MPLS to replace an old satellite-based system that they were using, which for them saved them a huge amount of money. So maybe MPLS might be a bit scary if you're trying to sell IP or ISDN codecs or other telco type gear, but the benefits that it has for somebody who's using it as an end subscriber, it's there. There's money saving opportunities.
So I think a lot of us get the promise of IP that someday the only pipe or pipes into and out of our broadcast facilities will be IP, and we'll get all of our... Now, they may not be from the same provider. You know, just like at the Twit Network that we're broadcasting over right now on the internet, there's more than one provider bringing IP services into and out of the brick Twit house. And I think that's smart for any radio station. If you've got the ability to get some fiber and a cable company connection and maybe some kind of DSL connectivity, it might take that kind of thing to make sure you always have some connectivity. But yeah, I can sure see how stations will eventually be able to drop T1 type circuits and PRI type circuits, which traditionally have been well tariffed, regulated, and in many cases pretty expensive. Where we're going to I think ideal is where you have a situation where you can get providers, you know, to get you the best price, to bid against each other, to compete a little bit for your business. I know here in Nashville, where I live, you've got Time Warner, Comcast, XO Communications, and AT&T. And if you're in the right part of town, you got a choice of any of these people to provide you with connectivity. It seems like that kind of competition can help make sure that you're going to get a right price. Whereas, you know, before, hey, if you wanted T1 in a lot of locations, you had exactly one choice. Bob, is that your thinking on this subject as well?
It is. Don't always go directly to the incumbent. You know, usually they will have the most safety blanket type approach if you go to the incumbent. But yeah, also throw RFPs around. You know, find out who else is able to provide you with the type of circuit you're looking for. Find out who's going to be able to provide you with the best cost. If they give you something as far as a price layout that you don't necessarily like, a lot of them, you know, you can push them back. As long as the sales guy thinks, all right, I might have a chance of future sales with these guys if I give them what they want initially. You're going to be able to use that, and you'll eventually get a different price. A lot of these things, the QoS-based services and stuff, they're not cheap. They're not. But you can recoup your costs, and I'm sure if Mr. Tobin was here, he'd be talking about total cost of ownership, because you can actually recoup a lot of that by getting rid of, maybe you don't need some additional staff. Again, in the case of broadcasters, I know a company that narrowed down their news fleet and pretty much centralized it because they were able to push stuff around quicker, and they didn't need to worry about, you know, expensive. In this case, it was all done by satellite. Beyond me, why they didn't go with something like an ISDN or whatever, but by leveraging technology, they're actually able to save money in people. Oh, well. In other costs, toll bypass. If you've got two different area codes that you're calling in between with VoIP, you're not getting charged per second or per minute for the long distance call. Thousands of different ways that people can leverage this. Even the idea of faxing. No, you just print to somebody else's printer, which is on the same network. Put in their IP. Boom. You know, you're printing at their desk instead of using a fax machine.
Guys, we are going to have to wrap it up. This has been fascinating. And I want to ask Bob. Bob, would you come back on the show again sometime? I feel like we've scratched the surface here, and there's probably a lot more that we can talk about, especially, I guess in both terms, in terms of you know, the bigger picture of how these services work, and then the tighter picture of how we as broadcast engineers can make sure we're choosing the right thing, that we're not trying to put something over the public internet that really oughtn't go over the public internet, and that on the other side, that we're not paying for services that we really don't need, that we're picking the right service from our providers for the type of goal that we're trying to accomplish. Would you be able to come back, Bob, and help us out some more?
Yeah, certainly. You're right. We did just kind of scratch at the surface, and we were all over the place as far as subject matter. But yeah. There's lots more stuff to talk about.
All right. Tell you what, let us do a quick giveaway here on our prize that we give away. We've been running a contest every week here on This Week in Radio Tech, where about an hour or two before the show starts, I will tweet. And if you follow me on Twitter, K Harnack, that's K-H-A-R-N-A-C-K, K Harnack, eventually I'll give out the Twitter handle for the show itself. I got to switch over to that. If you'll retweet that, you're entered to win a prize. And the prize is about $500 software. It's Omnia AXE. It is software that runs as a service in a Windows environment and lots of different versions of Windows. And it will do audio processing and stream encoding. So I use it at all my radio stations, and plenty of radio stations and other broadcasters do use it to get their stream to their service provider or to a Shoutcast server or even to a Wowza server, for example, for flash encoding. It's Omnia AXE. You can find out about it. On the website, omniaaudio.com/AXE. We're going to give away a license for that right now. And Bob, I'm going to ask you to do the honors of giving me, hang on a second, let me find, let's see, let's do a number between 1 and, let's make it 12. Can you give me a number between 1 and 12, Bob, at random?
All right, let's go with whomever was the quickest draw, number 1.
Number 1! Oh, gosh. Let's see. Hang on. I think it might be. Ooh. Wait a minute. I'm sorry. I'm real slow at this. Did we get. See who was first? Because this is just about public information. Well, you know, let's go with. Here we are. Drum roll, please. Tom.
Sounds like a cat.
I hope I'm pronouncing this right. We're going to go with Chris Arneson, who goes by the handle of Darkstar PDX of Hillsboro, Oregon, USA. Congratulations, Chris. You've won Omnia AXE. You've won Omnia AXE from This Week in Radio Tech. And the folks at Omnia. So I'll be in touch with you, Chris. Get in touch with you through Twitter, and we'll hook up and get you the license number for that. So thanks for playing, everyone. Thanks to everyone who retweeted, including some of my good friends who still haven't won yet. Bill Meeks, for example, Alexis Philippe, and a few others. We appreciate you. I appreciate you very much retweeting the fact that the show is starting. So, Bob, thanks again for being with us. Folks can reach you at ve7wnk.ca, an interesting website with lots of random thoughts from Bob Holowenko. Appreciate you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks, Kurt. And also with us, Chris Tarr from Quantico, Wisconsin, the ninja here, the geek Jedi. Chris, where can people meet up with you?
You can find out all about me at geekjedi.com. Links to all my sites and Twitter and all that kind of fun stuff.
Geekjedi.com. And Tom, are you awake? Oh, there you are.
Well, I'm here, sitting here listening, learning, and just fascinated by the subject. And quite frankly, I stay off of Chris's site because it scares me. But anyway, no, you can usually find me at W2TRR.com.
W2TRR.com. All right. Tom, thanks for being with us. Appreciate you very much. And all the hard work you do with the snowstorm up there, getting people back on the air and your own stations, too. All right. And I'm Kirk Harnack of founder of This Week in Radio Tech. And thanks to Colin. Thanks to also Leo Laporte, who inspired me to get this show on the air. And thanks to all of you in the chat room and those listening. Appreciate you very much. You can follow me at kharnack, Twitter handle kharnack. We also have a website for Twert. We have a Facebook page. If you want to follow us there, that'd be great. It's Twert, TWIRT. Appreciate you liking us, subscribing to us, whatever the heck you do on the Facebook tubes. That would be just wonderful. Hey, an upcoming episode, we've got some interesting guests. Bob Orban is going to be a guest on Triangulation sometime in the next few weeks. And immediately after that, same evening, Bob is going to be our guest on This Week in Radio Tech. Plenty more good guests, too, including, I'll tell you what, I'll keep it a secret until I know it for sure. Hey, thanks for joining us. Appreciate OmniaAudio.com being our sponsor. If you go to OmniaAudio.com, you'll see the countdown clock indicating the amount of time you've got to buy an Omnia 11 for $11,111.11. It's a celebration of the number 11. All right. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye.